sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, sorry, I have two pieces of ideology. One is that I like to take all of my talks because 1 in 10 is worth preserving and the cost is zero. And the second propaganda will come later. So, second bit of propaganda. Hello. Please take a copy of the handout. So, this is a modest talk. The goal is modest, so basically, and very, very technical. So in my previous talk here in Sydney at the topology seminar, I explained why I want a certain type of a tangle invariant, okay? And I'm not going to say anything about it today, except to say that maybe later, in a later talk, I will define it. I'll explain how to actually get it. But now I need a technical, I want to explain the technical tool that goes in. And I think the technical tool has some charm of its own because you don't think of Feynman diagrams as a subject in algebra, but I'll get to Feynman diagrams in a completely algebraic context. You think of it as if they live somewhere in quantum field theory. Okay, but I will get to them in a completely natural algebraic context. So the context is, so I want to carry out computations. So why computability, why I care about computability, I explained last time. And the computations that I need to talk about are, will turn out to be various, I need to compose various maps, linear maps, between one polynomial ring and another. Now, you may think it's low level, it's not, I don't know what, K-theory of reduced blah blah blah. It's very low level, just maps between polynomial rings and polynomial rings. But you see, if you have a map from one polynomial ring to another, a priori, you have to specify its value on each monomial. There are infinitely many monomials, so there are infinitely many values. So, so a priori, it's not computable. So when I say compute, I mean find a class of, or a subclass of the class of all maps between one polynomial ring and another, which will have a simple description, and for which the composition of two such maps can be computed from that description, and in which returns an output which is something of this that has the same description or the same type of description. And as I said, this will end up leading to Feynman diagrams. So I'm going to talk about joint work with Roland van der Veen. The handout for my talk, please take a copy of the handout, will be available at this URL. And my, it is available, sorry, at this URL. And my other bit of propaganda is to say that slide talks that go without a handout, or at least a URL where the handout can be found, should be banned. So I'm accepting myself. My talk maybe should not be banned. And the reason is, you know, you run through the talk and you completely lose what the symbol means. So if you have a handout, at least you can look back and see, okay? And furthermore, 1 in 5 talks, for me 1 in 10, but in general, so 1 in 5 talks is worth reading about again, and then at least you have something to keep, okay? Anyway, so here's my handout, and I hope you all have a copy. Good. So, oh, there is a secret slide. But let me still tell you what it says. So it turns out that there are lots and lots of invariants, Z, which are defined on knots and take values either in a universal enveloping algebra or in a quantized universal enveloping algebra. And by the PBW theorem, Zs are isomorphic to symmetric algebras. not as algebras, just as vector spaces. So basically, these algebras are polynomial rings. Symmetric algebras are just polynomial rings. So they are just polynomial rings with funny operations. Okay? So if you are to compute such invariants, you need to know how to compose operations involving funny operations involving polynomial rings, and that's what I'm going to tell you today. Okay, that's my goal. Anyway, also before I really start, so conventions. So if A is a set, I think I forgot the word finite, then C sub A is the column vector or the list of is a list of variables, one for each element of A. I will generally call them Zi, I runs in A. I think in this talk it's only that. But also, each variable automatically comes with a dual variable. So the dual variable of Zi is denoted zeta I. So zeta sub A is the list of dual variables. And just always when I will be talking about, variables will always come in pair. Latin and Greek, and Latin and Greek are dual to each other. And the second convention is that everything converges. Okay? So, I mean, algebra, so what that means is that everything is happening in either some power series ring where you can take the exponential of x and it has the power series meaning, or in some completed ring where you take some inverse limit of something, I don't know. I don't want to talk about it, I just want to assume it, okay? So don't ask me why do sums converge, they always do. Okay, good. So now here's the sort of one fundamental construction. So, I wish there was a pointer. You know, another rule should be that every room that has a projector should also have a bamboo stick. Well, okay. I mean, I do have a laser pointer, but laser pointers suck. Good. So, I want to tell you about the generating series. So if you have a homomorphism from one polynomial ring, so the polynomial ring is in variables z sub i in A, into another polynomial ring, you can represent it by a power series in variables dual to the input variables and the output variables. So I'll call this the generating series of that map. And what it is it's just a generating series of that map. Namely, if you have a function from polynomial rings in A, from polynomials in the variables in A to polynomials in the variables in B, I will map it to a power series in Z sub B and, oh, this should be an uppercase B, sorry, in Z sub B and zeta sub A I will look at the generating series of the list of outputs of this map F. So I will sum over all integers, or more precisely, lists of monomials, essentially. So if n runs in n to the a, then za to the n denote the monomial where you take each variable to the corresponding power. So I will sum over all monomials in the input. Well, for each such monomial, I will apply the map F, and then multiply it by this dual variable to the n, divide by n factorial, just for fun. N factorial means the sum, the product of all factorials of the components. And that's my generating function. That's D of F.
So this home is the vector space home?
Sorry?
This home is a vector space
home? Oh yeah, this home is a vector space home. It's just linear maps. Okay. A different way of saying it, I basically consider the zetas as auxiliary variables, and then F is a linear function in the Z's, or is a homomorphism in the Z's. If you think about the zetas as auxiliary variables, you can simply push them into the parentheses, and this becomes F evaluated on the exponential, and that's the generating series. Very simple. Okay? You can reverse the process, of course. So if you want to know if you have a generating series and you want to find what does the corresponding homomorphism does to a monomial, well, you look at the coefficient of the corresponding monomial in the zetas. Okay? A different way of saying it is to say that if you want to find what the homomorphism, the inverse of F, does to a polynomial P, where P is again a polynomial in the input variables, then you take the polynomial P, you replace all the Z's with differentiations with the relative to the corresponding zetas, evaluate it on F, and evaluate this at zeta equal to zero, and at all the zetas equal to zero. This effectively means that each monomial in P captures the corresponding monomial in F and outputs the corresponding combination of ZBs. Okay? So that's very easy. Now, if you have two such homomorphism, so F goes from polynomials in ZA to polynomials in ZB, G goes from polynomials in ZB to polynomials in ZC, and suppose our generating functions are F and G, then the generating function of their composition, oh, I suppose here's another piece of propaganda. Composition should be written from left to right, not reversing the direction like everybody else does, and then we should invent a new symbol to this, and for this, and the new symbol is double slash. Okay? So this means first do F, then do G. Okay? Basically, the generating function of the composition is you take the generating function of F, replace all the Z's in it, the output Z's in it, by differentiations and apply them to G and evaluate at zeta equal to zero. So pictorially, F is a box with Greek inputs and Latin outputs. So this is F. And what this means is that if I have a polynomial in Latin letters, so if I have ZA 1, ZA 2, then I pair them with the Greeks in the inputs, and I get an output. And now if I have a second G, and I want to compute the output, I need to pair the outputs here with the inputs here, and that's exactly what this differentiation with respect to the middle bar, so basically I replace every Latin here with a differentiation with respect to the corresponding Greek letter in the input for G and evaluated at all the Greeks equal to zero. Okay, so this is so basic, I hope I'm insulting you. Okay, if not, let me know.
So I'm just confused. So this map, this script D is not an isomorphism.
This map? D?
Yes.
In fact, it is. I mean, if you, I was a bit loose about which power series I'm allowed. In fact, if this is the correct ring of power series that you're using, then it is an isomorphism. I've done nothing. I just told you how to. Yeah, I mean, I'm basically encode right there.
But I'm confused. How the convergence of power series plays a role in this?
You're not allowed to ask about convergence. But convergence doesn't really play a role. I mean, this is a power series in the zetas, but polynomial in the z's. Or, you know, if you don't want to, it actually doesn't matter if it's an isomorphism or not. I mean, later I may have conditions that will say that some of the variables are small in some algebraic sense, and then convergence will be ensured. Okay? I think it's better if we see a few examples. Okay, but basically, okay, I don't know. Okay, so here are a few examples. So first of all, well, if you have an identity map from one polynomial ring to another, I don't know why I called it U here, but if you have an identity map from one polynomial ring to another, I think U was meant to be, for some funny reason, the polynomial ring in the Latin letters Y, B, A, and X. Okay, so the identity map from here to here will be defined by a generating series, which will be a series in 8 variables. So the duals of these variables and the variables themselves. So it will be represented by a power series in the variables y, b, a, and x for the outputs, and eta, beta, alpha, and psi for the inputs. And the recipe for computing this power series, so this will be, I don't know what to call it, well, D of the identity. So the recipe for computing this power series is to, well, the recipe in general is to take your operator and apply it to the exponential. So in our case, I have to take the identity operator and apply it to the exponential of the sum of each variable paired with its dual. So eta y plus beta b plus alpha a plus psi x. And I'm just applying the identity, so I'm doing nothing. So this is the generating series. Okay? Next example. So I want to compute the generating series for the operation product multiplication. So if you have a polynomial ring, in this case in one variable z, and another polynomial ring in the same variable z, and just my convention is that when I take the tensor product of spaces, then each tensor factor has a name. Okay? So this is the polynomial ring in Z placed in tensor factor I. This is same placed in tensor factor J. And there is the simple multiplication in the polynomial ring. And it maps, well, I'll call it MIJK, and it maps, well, it puts the product in a single tensor product, tensor factor, which I will call K. It's not terribly important, all of these naming conventions. And, I can think of this tensor product as simply polynomials in the two variables, Zi and Zj. And the output I can think of as polynomials in a single variable, Zk. And the product operation simply takes the variable of this and maps it to here, the variable of that and maps it to here, which amounts to saying map it, the MIJK operation maps Zi and Zj both to Zk. And so the generating series is given by when you apply the operation to the exponential of, well, the input variables paired with their duals. And, well, this operation simply takes Zi and Zj to Zk, so the result is the exponential of zeta I plus zeta j, two inputs, multiplied by Zk, the one output. Okay? The one thing to observe is that this was the exponential of a quadratic, and that this is again the exponential of a quadratic. Next. So the same story, but for a coproduct. So there is a standard coproduct on the polynomial ring, and you can think of it as a map from the polynomial ring in one variable zi to the polynomial ring in two variables zj and zk. As such, it's the map which maps zi to zj plus zk. You know, the more standard way to write it is to write that z gets mapped by the coproduct to z tensor 1 plus 1 tensor z, but this is zj and this is zk in my notation. So the generating series for it is you apply the operation to the exponential. Well, zi becomes zj plus zk, and we got again an exponentiated quadratic. Okay? More examples. So, here's a complicated example. So, let H be the Heisenberg algebra. So it's the algebra generated by two generators, X and Y, physicists would call them P and Q, such that the commutator of these two is H bar. And H bar is a scalar, so it commutes with everything. Okay? And let O sub I be the PBW ordering map. So it's the map which maps polynomial in xi and yi into hi. So this just means basically polynomials in xi and yi into h, the Heisenberg algebra, placed as an ith tensor factor. Okay? And it's the map which simply puts all the x's before all the y's, as PBW likes to do. Okay? And I want Heisenberg multiply to be essentially the product in the Heisenberg algebra. So really, it means that I take the product in the Heisenberg algebra, so it's a product from hi tensor hj into hk, just the usual product, and I compose it with the ordering map and the inverse ordering map, so that at the end, I get a map from the polynomial ring in xi, yi, xj, yj. Such polynomials can be represented via PBW, elements of hi tensor hj. And the output is in the polynomial ring of xk and yk. So I claim that the generating series for the product is the exponential of a quantity lambda, where the quantity lambda is written here, and again, it's a quadratic. The previous quadratics were always quadratics that were linear in Latin and linear in Greek. So if you look at them, they were quadratic of the form Greek times Latin here, and also here, Greek times Latin. This quadratic is also mostly Greek times Latin, like here, Greek times Latin. But it also has one term, which is, well, h is just a constant, times Greek times Greek. So I get more complicated. So I got a slightly more complicated quadratic, but it's still a quadratic. Anyway, proof. Actually, I'll give you two proofs. So one proof is, the Heisenberg algebra is defined by the Heisenberg commutation relation, but if you've seen quantum mechanics or if you've played with Heisenberg algebras, you know that there is an exponentiated version, which is the so-called vial form of the canonical commutation relations. And it says that if you want to commute e to the eta y with e to the xi x, so you want to rewrite it as e to the xi x times e to the eta y, you have to pay a price, and the price is this factor written here. Okay? And now, with this as background, let me compute the generating series of Heisenberg multiply. So I have to take the exponential of the simple pairing of the input between the Greek and the Latin variables, so that's what written here, and fit it into the chain of maps that defines the Heisenberg multiply, so into this chain of maps. So, namely, into O items or OJ times standard, followed by standard multiplication, followed by the inverse PBW map. Well, if I use OI and tensor OJ to order these, I get exponential of zeta I xi, so this becomes exponential of zeta I xi, exponential of eta I yi, okay? These were commuting variables. This product is already happening in the Heisenberg algebra, so it's a product between non-commuting quantities. Then I apply the multiplication of, so actually in this product, this part is in the I-th tensor factor, and this part is in the J-th tensor factor. Then I multiply the two and put the output in the K-th tensor factor, so the result is exactly the same, except all the variables became yk. Now I want to rewrite it as x before y, so I need to commute the middle two entries. Right? Because if I commute the middle two entries, the x's will be before the y's. But that's what the vowel form of the commutation relation does. So I get this output. So I've combined the x's, combined the y's, and paid the price. And then I need to un-PBW it. But it's already in sorted form. So un-PBWing it just means think of these variables as commuting back again. And then you can combine the exponentials and you get the exponential of lambda, which is what is written over there. Are you okay? Are you fine? Okay. Alternatively, I could have worked in a, really I'm telling you, here is a trick how to prove the vowel form of the commutation relations. Okay? So the trick is, you find a representation and you check everything in a representation. So you could represent X by this 3x3 matrix, you represent Y by this 3x3 matrix, and represent the scalars by this 3x3 matrix. And then let's check that this is indeed a representation. So this is actually already in computer code. So if I ask my computer to multiply row x with row y and subtract row y minus row x, and then I ask it, is it equal to h bar times row c, and then all the other commutation relations, namely that row c commutes with everything else, so I hit enter, and the computer prints out true, 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 so I know I found the representation. And then I set lambda to be the expression I told you about, and with blackboard E standing for matrix exponentiation, I test if the left-hand side, which is the exponential of psi I times x, times the except x represented, times the exponential of eta I times y, except y gets represented, and so on, whether it is equal to the right-hand side. Now, what's the right-hand side? The right-hand side, in the right-hand side, I should be taking, well, where is the right-hand side? I mean, it's here, right? So I should be taking the exponential of y, where y is taken with a coefficient, which is the coefficient of y inside lambda. And likewise for all the other terms, so I'm checking if this is the exponential of x, where x is taken with the coefficient, which is the coefficient of x within lambda. That's just the derivative of lambda with respect to x. Then I do the same for y, then I do the same for the scalar. I hit enter, the computer says true, and the theorem is proven. The reason I'm wasting your time with this is that the next exercise really requires this. Okay? So, the next exercise is...
So what you've really done is that you've taken the associated gradient of the universal enveloping algebra of the Heisenberg.
Yeah.
And you have encoded the multiplication on that to give you back the filtered version.
Yes.
And that's why you get this non-homogeneous.
Yes.
In your exponential.
Yes. So at the moment, what I'm doing, by the way, is I'm just building up for what types of maps I care about. So I care about maps whose generating functions look like Gaussians, so exponentials of quadratics. Okay? But now I'm taking some real-life example, and it's not no longer going to be an exponentiated quadratic, but a perturbed exponential quadratic. And then I'll, well, and these are the maps that I will need to learn how to compose. Okay? So anyway, so this is the first docile perturbed Gaussian differential operators example. Okay? So Gaussian, it should be clear, differential operators should be clear because everything ended up being about composing differential operators. Perturbed and docile, you'll see in a minute. Okay? So let SL2 plus epsilon, that's a funny Lie algebra, be the Lie algebra generated by four generators, Y, B, A, and X, are subject to some relations. The commutator of A with X is X, I don't know. Doesn't matter. Okay? If you look at these relations, you very quickly see that T, which is epsilon A minus B, is central. So really this Lie algebra is T plus the rest. And if epsilon is invertible, and you mod out by T, you're left with a three-dimensional Lie algebra, and that Lie algebra is simply SL2, by some rescaling. So really I'm telling you about SL2, but in some funny reparametrization, okay? Let CU, for classical algebra, be the universal enveloping algebra of this algebra, and let classical multiplication be the composition the same as in the Heisenberg algebra. So basically, you start from polynomials, you use the PW ordering, you map, then you multiply, and then you unorder. You use the inverse of the PBW map, and the ordering that I choose for the variables, for the generators, is the YBAX order. So YBAX. Okay? So I claim that the generating function for this multiplication is given by the exponential of lambda, where lambda is this awful expression. Well, awful or not, it encodes the multiplication of SL2. In fact, a little bit more than SL2 because of this extra central factor, but basically, you know, if you wanted to summarize the multiplication rule of SL2 in two lines, here's the summary, okay? It's of the right form, namely, it has Greek input variables dual to the Latin output variables. The output variables are yk, bk, a, and x, living in tensor factor k, and the inputs are the dual Greek letters, so alpha, beta in I and j, so alpha I, beta I, alpha j, I don't know, all of them appear. Okay? Anyway, proof. So what I need to verify is the identity written here, and I verify it by finding a faithful two-dimensional representation. And so the representation is Y gets represented by this matrix, B by this matrix, A by that, X by that. Here is a verification that this is the representation. So I ask my computer to check if A times X minus X times A really is X, and so on. I hit enter, the computer says 5 times true, So it's a representation. And then I ask the computer to carry out the multiplication that I need to carry out and simplify the result. And I hit enter, and the computer says true and QED. Okay, if you actually want to know how I found this formula...
Did the computer come up with your formula?
Maybe? Yes. I never found this formula myself. Okay. Right, basically I've run the same program, putting here unknown one, I don't know, U1, putting here U2, putting here, and then I type solve for U1, U2, U3, and that's what I got. In fact, that's not what I got. I sort of then had to massage it a bit to be in a nicer form, but basically, I have no clue where this formula comes from. It's just there. Okay? Good. So, I want to look at this formula a little bit. So, I failed to tell you that I would like to look at this algebra near epsilon equals to zero. Okay? So near epsilon, so in other words, I want to take lambda and expand it as a power series in epsilon. So here is again, I'm asking the computer to print lambda expanded as a power series in epsilon up to epsilon squared. So the first two lines are the term independent of epsilon. The next two lines are the coefficient of epsilon. The next two lines are the coefficient of epsilon squared. And I ask you for the moment to ignore the lower half of the alphabet, Greek and Latin. So, in other words, I want you to regard A, B, alpha, and beta as constants. They are not, but I'll get back to it later, okay? So, with this, if you do that, then, again, the part independent of epsilon is a quadratic, so this is a quadratic, this is quadratic, this is a quadratic with a funny coefficient, e to the minus alpha, but I asked you to think of e to the minus alpha as a constant, so it's still a quadratic. This is again a quadratic, again with a Greek term. Basically, everything is a quadratic. And the perturbation has the property, which you can verify by inspection up to this degree and then prove with zero effort. It has the property that the coefficient of epsilon to the k, if you call it p up k, then p up k has degree which is at most 2k plus 2. Okay? So that's what docile means. So I'm allowing you to perturb Gaussians provided the coefficient of epsilon to the k is bounded. In fact, bounded by 2k plus 2. Okay, so the last note here is what to do about the other part, the lower half of the alphabet. Let's keep it for the end. Okay. Last example. So if T is the quadratic Casimir of Lie algebra, so basically T is going to be x tensor y plus y tensor x plus whatever other generators you have. And then you exponentiate it, well, it's clearly the exponential of a quadratic. So the output, when regarded as an element of the second tensor power of the symmetric algebra, or, you know, since I'm talking always about homomorphisms, then this is really a homomorphism from the empty polynomial ring, so from the polynomial ring in zero variables to the polynomial ring in twice the number of generators as in the Lie algebra. So this element will be dominated by something Latin. Okay? So I need quadratics that have all sorts of things, okay? Both Greek and Latin and Latin, and I also need perturbations. So definition. All of this was background. Okay? Or examples. Now definitions. So let dopegdo, docile perturbed Gaussian differential operators, be the category whose objects are finite sets, and there are lots of footnotes to deal with the lower half of the alphabet, but we'll talk about them later. Okay? and where the morphisms between a finite set A and a finite set B will be functions of the form omega times the exponential of q plus p, and these are power series in Greek letters corresponding to A and Latin letters corresponding to B, where omega is a scalar, again, small print later, q is a quadratic in all the variables involved, so the Greeks and the Latins, small print later, and the quadratic should be small so that you would be able to exponentiate it, but I'm not quantifying what small means. There will be some small parameter somewhere, something, okay? And P is a docile perturbation. So P is the sum of epsilon to the k pk, where the degree of pk is less than 2k plus 2. And finally, how do you compose? So the composition of two such things is obtained by the formula of before. Namely, you pair the Greeks of the output of F with the, sorry, you pair the Latins in the output of F with the Greeks in the inputs for G, or equivalently the other way around. Okay? It's not obvious that the composition of two such things is again such a thing. This will come later. Okay. So what? Maybe even before compositions, who cares? Why should you care? So, there are two reasons why you should care. Okay? So, one reason is that a more standard way of doing computations in universal enveloping algebras is to choose representations. Okay? If you need to work with several copies of a universal enveloping algebra, you end up looking at tensor powers of your representation, and tensor powers explode. The dimension of the n tensor power of v grows exponentially as a function of n. So your computations, if they involve multiple copies of the algebra, are bound to be slow. Whereas, if you bound the power of epsilon, the rank of the space of morphisms grows relatively slowly. Namely, the space of quadratics in that many variables, well, quadratics are just defined by matrices, so the number of quadratics is the square of the number of variables. If the number of variables, if you take many copies of your algebra and the number of variables gets multiplied by n, the number of quadratics gets multiplied by n squared. So it's a relatively small number. And similarly for polynomials, so the perturbation polynomials, provided you bound their degree. Provided you're looking only up to degree 3 in perturbation theory, or some fixed small degree. So that's one advantage. And the other advantage is that representation theory actually kills a part of the structure, whereas this retains it. So, I don't know if I should say that. Maybe I should move on. But basically, if you want to understand the coproduct really well, this is a better setup than representation. Okay. Okay, so I still have to explain compositions. Okay? So suppose you have a morphism from a finite set A to a finite set B. The main part of it is some quadratic. This quadratic can be decomposed into three pieces. The Greek Latin piece, the Greek Greek piece, which I will call F, the first one is E, and the Latin Latin piece, which I will call G. Okay? And the pictorially, the quadratic Q, so if I have two such morphisms, F1 and F2, and I want to compose them and get an output, then the quadratic piece of the first morphism, Q1, will be decomposed into an E1, F1, and G1, where E1 goes across, so it connects Greek to Latin. F is Greek, and G is Latin. Likewise for the second morphism, and likewise for the output morphism, which I'm still trying to compute. Okay? But I will also have a scalar omega 1 for the first morphism, a scalar omega 2 for the second, and omega for the last, and I'll have a perturbation term which should be docile. So this is really a power series in epsilon, and the number of legs is smaller than 2k plus 2, whatever it was, but basically it has parts on both sides. It's both Greek and Latin, and likewise here it's both Greek and Latin, and likewise for the output. Now I want to compose these things. How does composition work? So composition works by pairing the variables here with the variables here in all possible ways. Right? I mean, that's exactly what del zeta to the power n acting on z to the power, sorry, del, wait, Latin becomes, where, right, sorry. So this is exactly, I mean, doing this and evaluating at zeta equals to zero just means that you pair the z's from here with the zetas on the right. Okay? Except all of these things are exponentiated. So you don't just get a single line going across, but you know the exponential, so again I'm reminding you of silly thing, right? X e to the x is 1 plus x times x divided by 2 plus so on, which amounts to saying that the quadratic is not just a single line going across, but really you should be thinking of it as a no line plus one line plus two lines plus three lines with some combinatorial factors. Okay? And then I need to pair ends with ends. So my picture looks like this. Oops. Let us for the beginning, for the start, just compute the quadratic piece of the output. So I want to compose this. So this is E1, F1, and G1. And I want to compose it with E2, F2, and G2, and see what the result might be. But you see, each E is really a multiple, each F is really a multiple, each G is really a multiple, and so forth, and similarly for the other side. So, and composition means some overall possible ways of connecting the ends from here to the starts here. So, up to combinatorial factors, how can I get a term that goes across in the output? Namely, I'm trying to compute the Greek-Latin part of the output. Well, I have to start on the left. If I connect to one of these, I'm stuck. So I better connect to E1. So this part, E, will look like E1 times. Now then I can simply go across, so I'll get E1 times E2. But there are other possibilities. I could go using E1 get to here, then connect to an F2. So I could get E1, F2, then connect to a G1. Now I'm here, and then I go out by connecting to an E2. So E2. Or I could have gone through this FG loop twice instead of once. So I could have gone E1, F2, G1, F2 again, G1 again, and then go out with E2. And so on. But that's a geometric series in the middle with F2G1. So by the formula for the sum of a geometric series, this is E1 times 1 minus F2G1 inverse times E2. And this is the formula I wrote here for the E of the output. I'm terribly sorry about that. Okay? Likewise, what's the F of the output? So I enter from the left. I could simply go back with F1. This is this term. Or I could do an E1, cycle around the FG loop, and then come back with E1 transpose. And this is the formula written here. And likewise for everything else. And you know, there is also a term with omega. So the term with omega is because you can have simply independent loops. These produce scalars, and these modify the scalar of the output, and you can check that the scalar you get is the determinant of 1 minus F2G1 inverse. Okay? So that's the quadratic part. And now, the perturbation part. So how do I get a P part for the answer? Okay? So, basically I need to take if I want to look at the part of P which is proportional to epsilon to the K, I need to somehow get K epsilons, and I can get some of them from the left and some of them from the right, and there are only finitely many ways to do it because K is finite. So I could be getting finitely many p's labeled 1, so these are the p's coming from the left, and another finite number of p's labeled 2, these are the p's coming from the right. And then I enter, I go through these p's, I connect them in some funny ways, and I output. So the connections are written here, and some of the connections are direct, like the third output of the first P could be connected to the first input of the second P. But some of the connections, and that's what the lines here indicate, might go through, instead of going from here directly to here, you might be going through the FG loop a number of times. Okay? So that's the result. Like it or not, these are Feynman diagrams. This is what... That's exactly Feynman diagrams, and I got there from a completely natural type of questions about composing polynomial maps between polynomial rings. And the types of maps are maps that I care about, maps that you could care about too. How much time do I have?
-2.
-2. Oh. So I'll take +2. Sorry, is this okay? Okay, very quickly. Well, really I should have been, in order to deal with also the lower half of the alphabet, I should have switched to a situation in which the variables have weights, and then there are some rules about how the weights combine, or how the things behave relative to the weights, and then you can check that this indeed remains a docile perturbed Gaussian even with these weights put on, and you can check that composition still makes sense. So now all the n's also have weights, and the weights are either 1, in which case I don't mark anything, or 0 or 2, in which case I mark them in green or red, and you can check that the same rules apply and nothing breaks by the fact that the weight zero things are actually now less constrained. Okay? And sorry, I would have said more, but I'm running out of time. and the full composition now needs to be done in two pieces. So one piece for the lower half of the alphabet, or in two steps. One step for the lower half of the alphabet, one step for the upper half of the alphabet, or namely for the 0-2 pieces and for the 1-1 pieces. And basically the 0-2, the 1-1 piece is basically exactly what I described, except instead of the ring, the underlying ring being the rational numbers, it's the ring of power series in the weight zero variables, and the 0-2 phase is done in a way where the weight one variables are just spectators, so just parameters, kind of non-participating coefficients. Okay? And I still want to ask some questions. So I actually don't have a quantum field theory precedent for, well, a quantum field theory in which the Lagrangian is somehow has two pieces and it's not quite quadratic, but after you integrate the first piece, the second piece becomes quadratic, which is what happens here. And my second question is that in quantum field theory, so a lot of what is done here is analogous to quantum field theory. So, I mean, I didn't say anything about it, but the Feynman diagrams that I have to deal with are always connected, and this is the same principle as why the logarithm of the partition function in quantum field theory is always represented by connected Feynman diagrams. It's, so in quantum field theory, people do other things, they look at one particle irreducible diagrams, effective action. I don't know what it means. And then my last question, in our context, and then my last question is, well, I am going to use this technology in order to build knot invariants. But the technology is much, much, much more general. And, well, maybe you have other uses. Sorry for running over time. Sorry for wasting your time. Thank you for listening. Any questions?
Are there any urgent questions?
I should have said one. Sorry. I didn't understand what role the docile condition played.
Finiteness. So, okay. Basically, so if these vertices were allowed to have many legs, infinitely many legs, then you'd get infinitely many Feynman diagrams, and then convergence will be an issue. And why docile exactly? Because docile is preserved by composition. So this is something to check, that if all the vertices are of degree less than the power of epsilon, then after you compose, the result is again of degree less than the power of epsilon. Sorry, 2k plus 2, not 5s. So this is something to check, that the docility condition is the condition that is preserved by this composition. Okay?
So yes, sort of relating to the universal enveloping algebra paradigm, which you started with, it seems that the Latin letters increase degree by one, the Greek ones decrease by one, and you've considered quadratics. Yeah, what is the special role of quadratics?
I'm not sure I know how to answer in this language. Okay, so
I mean, there is your example. Why should you not have higher degree terms?
So because then I will not know how to compose. Because this,
Yeah, you wouldn't get a picture. computer like that?
Because, well, then I wouldn't get convergence. So, first of all, quadratics behaves relatively well. And in fact, by the way, even the fact that you can get a category out of quadratics, so you can restrict the peg dot to the case epsilon is equal to zero. Just ignore the power, say, the perturbation. And then you simply get a category even out of quadratics. I think even this category is not considered by elsewhere. So it's a lovely construction in itself, and it's given by these funny formulas here. But quadratics allow for these formulas if you put higher degree things, so things which are of higher degree in the Greek and Latin variables, and you put them at epsilon equals to zero, then I wouldn't know how to compute. Okay? So that's a good thing about quadratics, and then the other good thing is that they actually come up in the examples, and for one of the examples, I actually had to massage the algebra so that I will get docile perturbed Gaussian. So I had to not take just SL2, but SL2 with some epsilon thrown in. Now, I could tell you what this epsilon is. That's a fun story in itself. It's canonical. It makes sense for all the algebras, not just for SL2. But I'm already way out of our time, so.
So, thanks, Peter. I'm going to go to Schenken, so speed outside.